Welcome to VOA's International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. works to broker a ceasefire in Syria. The CIA tweets details of the bin Laden operation. A life-saving heart patch is being tweaked. And Prince writing country music?
Prince could excel in any genre he put his mind to, and frequently did. And during his entire life, he dabbled in other genres under different pseudonames.
It's here on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he is getting closer to a place of understanding on restarting a ceasefire in Syria that includes the largest city, Aleppo, where the death toll from airstrikes continued to mount today. Correspondent Luis Ramirez is following developments and joins us on the line. Hi, Luis.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, what have you heard about Secretary Kerry's ceasefire efforts?
Well, it's a very, very slow, painful process because, of course, his visit to Geneva is complicated by the fact that one of the key players in this whole affair, which is Russia, is not present at those talks. So Secretary Kerry is doing what he can, discussing with other partners, the Saudis, the Jordanians, and the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura. He had meetings with all three of them, both Sunday night just off the plane and then all day Monday. And what has emerged is what the secretary says are several proposals, he said, are going back to key players to sign off. Again, one of those key players is Russia. The United States has called on Russia to help stop the carnage in Aleppo because, well, it has influence over the Assad government and believes that Moscow can, in fact, step in to stop that. The problem here is whether Moscow will do it or not. Thus far, they have defended those airstrikes.
Well, do we have any idea what's in these proposals?
Secretary Kerry is giving no details on what those proposals are. Observers say that they could include a partial ceasefire, that is, one that will protect at least certain parts of Aleppo. The Secretary's position, the United States' position, has been all along that the ceasefire agreement reached in February and that was brokered by the U.S. and Russia should cover all of Syria, including all of Aleppo, and that the airstrikes that have been going on over the past 11 days, claiming more than 200 lives are outside of that ceasefire or in violation of it. And so the efforts are for if Assad cannot be convinced to stop the airstrikes in Aleppo, in the entire city, at least have some safe zones created. But those are just words from observers. We're waiting to hear back on exactly what's contained in those proposals.
And what about Russia? I mean, you touched on this a little bit, but why aren't they showing up at the party?
Well, they have defended Syria's actions, the Syrian government's actions in Aleppo, saying that these are anti-terrorist operations, that the Syrian warplanes have been going in there to take out operatives of the al-Nusra Front, which both the United States and Russia, and also, of course, the Assad government, consider a terrorist group. And so Russia says these attacks are justified. They're part of a cleanup effort as the Assad government moves into secure Aleppo, a very important, very strategic point for them since we're talking about Syria's largest city.
And what have we been hearing out of Aleppo?
The Syrian military called for a temporary calm starting on Friday. That was meant to stop some of the criticism that really has intensified since the attack on a hospital that was supported by Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. That was a terrible scene in which children were killed and medical staff that included one of the city's last pediatricians. That was a real public relations debacle, and just the horror of the scene mobilized, it seems, everyone to call for an end to the carnage. So the government, the Syrian government, called this temporary calm, and that seemed to help. There were reports that some of the fighting did subside throughout the country, although there are reports on Monday of continued attacks in Aleppo.
Well, thank you very much, Luis.
Thank you, Susan.
For a look at what's going on the web concerning this story, we're joined at the anchor desk by social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, as always, Andrew.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you. What are people saying?
Well, there's a lot of questions about this plan, what it's going to mean, how it might be implemented.
Also, a lot of questions on social media about this brokered silence. People questioning, what does that mean exactly? How is that different than a cessation of fighting? Is it the same thing? And if it is, why can't they just use the same name? So there's a lot of details that people are focusing on with this ongoing crisis and this plan.
Diplomatic talk is all about. You know, they're very careful which little term they use.
Exactly. And social media, to the credit of the Twitter users, are very keen on those details and are picking them out. Another way that social media is being used, New York Times Cairo chief Declan Walsh, he's actually soliciting questions on social media. He's asking people to tweet him. The New York Times is asking people to tweet him with their questions about Syria, and they're going to use social media as kind of a way to collect those questions and then answer them to spread some more information. So it's a good way to disseminate some information using the social media.
They should use that with some other things, too.
Yeah, and other organizations have, so hopefully this is a trend and it's incorporated more.
And you have something else to talk about today, and it's so complicated I didn't understand it when you were explaining it to me earlier, so I'll let you explain it.
It's a big story. WhatsApp, the popular messaging app, is being banned in Brazil for 72 hours. So this has taken over Twitter. Oftentimes we see this when something happens on one social medium, it becomes trending on another. So over 320,000 tweets about WhatsApp in just the past few hours as Brazil's announced this ban. A lot of questions there about why they're doing that. It seems to be a data issue with Facebook. Sometimes when companies are being investigated or there's a dispute with the government, they'll shut down some of their social media. And WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, so that seems to be the case here. So a lot of people unhappy in Brazil, to say the least, that messaging app is being shut down. They're wondering what else they can do. They might be turning to other social media to share their thoughts.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
And we invite everybody to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. reports progress on Syria's ceasefire. Tense calm in Baghdad as Iraqi political process is in danger of unraveling. Trump says the U.S. can't continue to allow China to rape our country. Puerto Rico is defaulting on a $400 million payment. First U.S. passenger cruise ship in decades sails to Cuba. News, feature reports, and more on the VOA.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Many dog owners like to show affection by hugging them. But a recent article in Psychology Today indicates that giving Fido a hug may not be such a good idea. The article, written by Stanley Coren, a psychology professor and author of several books on dog behavior, suggests that you really shouldn't hug dogs because it raises their stress and anxiety levels. Coren looked at 250 random pictures of people or their children hugging their dogs and looked for signs that indicated the dog wasn't happy being hugged. Those signs include dogs who turn their head away, close their eyes, lower the ears, or their slick back against the side of their head. Other signs of a dog's stress and anxiety can include yawning, licking his lips, or even licking your face. Rather than showing fondness for your dog with a hug, Coren suggests that you give your pet a pat, a kind word, or maybe a treat. Good dog. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United States ultra-secretive Central Intelligence Agency has tweeted out details of an operation that killed top terrorist leader Osama bin Laden 5 years ago. National Affairs correspondent Jeff Seldon joins us here in the studio to talk about it all. Welcome, Jeff.
I'm glad to be here.
This is an interesting. What did the tweet say?
Well, it's interesting. The CIA has been on Twitter since June 2014. And just to put it in perspective, they've been trying to take an approach to social media that might be softening up the CIA's image. Their first tweet was, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet."
You covered this story when it first broke.
Exactly, exactly. And so this is something that they've been working up to for a while. They've been trying to use Twitter as a way, and other social media as a way, to reach out to people, let them know what CIA is doing, a bit more transparency, or at least as much transparency as you can have for an international spy organization. But what they started doing on the anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden and the raid that killed Osama bin Laden is they said to mark that anniversary, they were going to tweet basically in real time the raid as it would have happened 5 years ago. So one of their first tweets was 1:25 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at POTUS, the president, the director of the CIA, Panetta, and the JSOC commander approve execution of op in Abbottabad. And then they went on from there, talking tweets about helicopters depart from Afghanistan for the compound and so on and so forth, right up to through the moment of his death. Now, the reaction was some people were saying this is appropriate. Some Americans were saying they're proud of their country, proud of the way the CIA was trying to pay tribute to the special operations forces that carried out that raid and basically took out and killed the terrorist mastermind behind the September 11th attacks. Other people were not so happy about it. There were a lot of comments on Twitter saying that this was inappropriate. One Twitter user wrote, "This is gross as hell. Please stop." And so there's been a lot of reaction to this, a lot of visceral reaction to this, because it is, after all, such a hot-button topic.
It is. It's a delicate topic, and I wonder what their thinking was to put it out on Twitter as opposed to having a news conference or something else to mark the occasion.
Well, the CIA pointed out that this is something that they've done, not in this exact way with the real-time tweets replaying events, but using Twitter to mark other historical events. They say it's been a key element of their social media efforts, and they say in the past they've put out tweets noting historical events such as Argo, the shootdown of the U-2 spy plane, the evacuation of Saigon. There's also been tweets commemorating the Bay of Pigs incident in Cuba, and they say they've done similar things with those. It hasn't gotten nearly as much attention, obviously. Again, different types of issues. Those much more historical. Many people alive today weren't alive when those events took place. The events of September 11th, the raid that took out Osama bin Laden, much closer to living history than other types of history.
I wonder if there's a lot more information that the CIA has that has not been made public.
There's always a lot more information that intelligence agencies have than what they've made public. A lot of the information that they put out in these tweets, even though it was sort of a blow-by-blow account of what happened, not exactly new. It's parts of the story that have been put together since the U.S. announced that it had carried out the raid. And remember, the CIA over the past year or so has twice released information that it gathered from the raid, calling it bin Laden's bookshelf, talking about the documents they found and what they've learned from that. So there's been some transparency. These tweets just basically replayed the events. It's like listening to a play-by-play of a sports event years after the fact. And they use Twitter to do that in order, in their words, to commemorate this history of the event.
The five-year anniversary. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeff, and I appreciate you coming in because I know you covered this story when it first happened. It's great that you're on right now, too. Appreciate it.
And there's going to be more information coming out. The CIA is hoping to release some additional information. They've done it twice. They were hoping for a third release of some information from that raid 5 years ago that led to the death of Osama bin Laden. It'll be interesting to see what they release.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Jeff.
Anytime.
Coming up on International Edition, a heart patch that may save you, and Prince as a country music dabbler. Suffering from a broken heart, not the type linked to love, but your real heart. Well, scientists in Israel have created a life-saving heart patch that can monitor and help treat cardiac problems. Reporter Deborah Block has been writing about this invention and joins us on the line. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Susan.
Hey, how does this device work on the body?
This is absolutely fascinating. Researchers at Tel Aviv University developed this revolutionary 3D printed patch consisting of nanoelectronics. That's that super tiny technology that's used in computer chips and microscopic devices, and they combine that with live heart tissue grown in a lab. And this device, which is actually applied to the heart, can actually regenerate the cardiac muscle by building up cells in the part with a defect, or for people that have had a heart attack. Now, the role of the electronics is to actually sense the function of the tissue and then activate it when needed. And the device can also release medication for heart problems related to things like inflammation or a lack of oxygen. I mean, it's an amazing technology.
And doctors can remotely respond when there is an issue?
Yes, they can. Because this patch can expand like a heart, but it's also a self-regulating machine, a doctor can treat his patient from afar. For example, let's say the patient is at home and not feeling well and has a heart problem, so pretty much knows something's going on. They can contact the physician who can immediately see the condition of the heart on his computer and can remotely activate the heart, providing electrical stimulation and releasing drugs. Again, that's something we can't even imagine now.
Well, who is this device really for?
Well, the device really will be for a lot of people. Obviously, the device will be for people who have a damaged heart, maybe from birth or from other problems, and especially, of course, for people who have heart attacks. And the thinking is that this patch could become an alternative to a heart transplant, and the technology could even lead to more promising discoveries, you know, other organs that can have a patch on it, and then the cells can be regenerated, so the organ starts working again.
Well, is this ready for the general public?
No, not yet. For those of us who might need this now, it looks like it could be at least 10, 20 years before this could be available and other bionic organs in the market. Also, I should tell you that besides Israel, Stanford University in California is also working on their patch. They have discovered that a protein can be administered via a patch to help repair damage from a heart attack. So perhaps with all this research going on, maybe luckily we can have it a little bit sooner. But right now, it looks like it's going to be years before the technology is available.
Well, I just thought of an old-fashioned remedy for a broken heart, Deborah.
And what is that, Susan?
Get a dog.
Oh, we're back to the dog. You know that makes me smile.
Okay, thank you.
My dog makes my heart beat very well every day.
Okay, thanks a lot, Deborah. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
The late performer Prince was primarily known for his pop, rock, soul, and funk-infused grooves. But did you know Prince also dabbled in country music? Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to give us another glimpse into the rich legacy of Prince.
Well, so Nikki, does Prince have a country album hidden in his secret vault of unreleased music?
I think he probably does. He probably does. For right now, we can't say for sure because it's still locked up. But one thing we do know is that Prince could excel in any genre he put his mind to and frequently did. And during his entire life, he dabbled in other genres under different pseudonames. One of those names is Joey Coco.
So he wrote for Kenny Rogers under that name, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. So Kenny was one of the artist he wrote for under that name. He wrote the song You're My Love that Kenny recorded for his 1986 album They Don't Make Them Like They Used To. And he also wrote Telepathy for country artist Deborah Allen.
So how did he and Kenny Rogers get together?
Okay, well, Kenny Rogers had been a big fan of Prince, like the rest of the world. And in the 80s, Kenny said he con
contacted Prince through a mutual friend and asked if he would write him a song. And Prince actually did. And on his Facebook page, Kenny Rogers says that when he sent the song to me, if I remember right, it was him playing all of the instruments on it and he had his background vocals on it. He said, unfortunately, on the finished record, somehow my producer didn't end up using the music or vocals. The song was recut. He then goes on to say, it was such an incredible thing that Prince took the time to do that for me. He was a brilliant guy and a gifted musician with a lot of feelings. And you could tell his feelings went far deeper than what was written on his face.
That's You're My Love by Kenny Rogers, written by Joey Coco, also known as Prince.
Yes, that is the song. And I will be playing that track in full this week on Country Hits USA in tribute.
Oh, great. Well, you can hear Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
You want to know if I care for you? You ought to know. Just pretending, yeah. You know how I feel. 'Cause baby, you're my love, and I love everything you do to me. You're my love, and I love when you're around. You're
If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the 2015 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices issued by the State Department in mid-April, Russia's authoritarian government continues to commit and ignore numerous human rights violations. First, citizens' right to choose their leadership in free and fair elections was consistently restricted through the government's efforts to suppress dissent. New and existing repressive laws were used to harass, discredit, and punish individuals and organizations that criticized the government. The government particularly targeted those who spoke up in support of the government of Ukraine or opposed the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. Further, the Russian government continued to selectively prosecute racial, ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities and migrant workers. In addition, officials denied due process to defendants in politically motivated cases. The government used secret detentions and convictions based on questionable treason and espionage charges, and even tried and convicted non-Russian citizens taken illegally from other countries, especially Ukraine. Yet at the same time, authorities failed to bring to justice individuals responsible for the deaths of prominent journalists, activists, whistleblowers, and opposition politicians. Indeed, Russia's support of separatists in eastern Ukraine and its two-year occupation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula were responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in the region. According to international monitors and human rights NGOs, the combined Russian separatist forces in the Donbas region and the Russian occupation authorities in Crimea caused thousands of civilian deaths and injuries. Russian occupation authorities in Crimea cracked down on members of certain groups, in particular Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, who spoke out in opposition to the occupation. And finally, conflict in northern Caucasus between government forces, insurgents, Islamist militants, and criminal forces led to numerous human rights abuses and a general degradation in the rule of law. Such abuses imperil the future of Russia and its people. In the words of Secretary of State John Kerry, a government that fails to respect human rights, no matter how lofty its pretensions, has very little to boast about, to teach, and very little indeed in the way of reaching its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.